Welcome back to the Puckin' Pod. On today's episode, we discuss the last Leafs and Canucks game before the Four Nations Tournament. We also talk about the Super Bowl. And then we discuss the NBA trade deadline. And finally, we discuss our favorite romance films. That's all coming up next right here on the Puckin' Pod. Let's puckin' go. Well, boys, we are back for another episode. It's the Puckin' Pod. My name is Joe.
My name is Brandon.
And I'm Paul.
Well, boys, we got a lot to talk about. I think we should probably go back to a special game that happened in the NHL last Saturday. What do you think?
I don't know of any game that happened in the NHL last Saturday, period, Joe.
The Canucks versus the Toronto Maple Leafs. It was the last game before, of course, the Four Nations face-off takes place, and we've got a little NHL break. I think we should talk a little bit about the Canucks and Leafs game. What do you think?
Well, of course we should.
Now, as Leaf fans...
Reluctantly.
Yeah. as Leaf fans, let me ask you guys, what is your overall kind of consensus of the game? How do you feel about the game overall?
I thought it was a pretty even game for the most part, to be honest. A couple of blunders and boneheaded mistakes that led to, you know, obviously the outcome for the Canucks. but yeah, I thought actually it was pretty entertaining. It was pretty even. Can't complain. I enjoyed it.
The first period I thought was okay from a Leaf side. Vancouver came out, was flying and came out flying the entire game. They always seem to. I only got to watch two periods, and then I actually had to brush off to my own gig.
Yeah, I had a thing too. I couldn't watch the rest of the game either.
After I set up at my gig, it was on the TV where I was at, and I was just kind of picking at the score and stuff. But, I mean, it was a better game than the first time around, but the result obviously wasn't there. I don't know what it is. And don't take this the wrong way, Joe, because Vancouver is quite a few points less in the standings than Toronto, but they just can't seem to get up for games that really do mean something at the end of the year. Yet when they play a team like Tampa or Florida, they bring their best. And I'm not saying that the Canucks didn't deserve to win or don't deserve to win, because they play hard. And I just don't understand why that mind... What is that mindset that's different? And you can speculate all day long, but really at the end of the day, it's up to the players. The coaches can prepare them as much as they can, but it's up to the players to execute. And they're not doing that. And then it's like, you're just throwing 2 points away all the time, consistently. You play Columbus, you play Montreal, you play these teams that are well below you, and you don't show up for the game, or you don't start on time.
Yeah.
That cliche phrase, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm so tired of it. It's frustrating to watch. They need something. Something has to change with this team, and I'm getting to that point now where the frustration's starting to boil over about it, and I know we're 2-3 weeks away from the trade deadline, but I don't know. It something's not sitting right with me. I like the style. I like the coach. I like, for the most part, the roster construction, but there's something going on and I don't know what it is.
Got to wonder, like, with that mental mindset of, you know, teams that are lesser than you in the standings, like the effort level is in their brain, is their effort level lesser than the teams that, you know, they're fighting for top spot in the league? Like, it really makes me question, you know, like I said, the mental preparedness for games like that. Like it's one thing to know that you're great, but you know, it's not just like a confidence or you know, manifestation of your mindset for it. It really has to be effort in, effort out, regardless of where the teams are in the standings. And you know, you're not just doing this for yourselves, it's like the other players on your team, and for your place in the standings. You're doing this for the fans too, you know, the ones that are at home if you're away, or when you're there. Like there's more to these professional sports than just the game itself. It is everyone else that's involved with it, and that's, I find, concerning too at times.
Yeah, you know, I think I totally know where you guys are coming from. I think there's sort of a comparison to like Vancouver last year when they were
playing so well under Rick Tocchet. There's a lot of different sort of speculation as to why they played the way they have been playing the way they've been playing in terms of, you know, winning the last three games before the break. They're playing without Quinn Hughes, which is one part that most people forget, right? So you have to elevate your game, first of all, because you're missing your star player, your star defenseman, and your captain. But also, there is a lot of speculation that the Canucks are starting to turn it on for the remainder of the season. What the speculation is, of course, is that the first half of the season up until this point, they've been kind of sitting back a little bit. And the reason for that is because of what happened in the playoffs last year, where they just literally tired themselves out and, you know, lost out in the second round. So by taking it easy in the first round, again, this is speculation, but by taking it easy in the first half of the season, you can now start ramping up your game and try to make the playoffs and then, you know, pour it on. Now, again, that's just speculation. It doesn't necessarily mean that's exactly what's happening. But there's also the mindset of, you know, you've got a team like Toronto coming into your building who brings fans with them, right? The fans from the Toronto Maple Leaf fans do fill those rinks too. And they're usually louder, if not as loud as the home team fans. So that can also pump a team up to want to play better too. So they're going to show up more so than the Leafs are just for that reason alone too.
You know, it does kind of concern me in that, to that regards, in terms of conditioning, right? Is there a conditioning concern with the fact that, you know, maybe you're not trying so hard in the beginning of the season, but you're going to try harder at the end of the season? I get trying to leave a little bit in the tank, but, you know, these are the top athletes in the world, right? And it's something where I feel the conditioning should be on par all the time. I don't really feel there's an excuse for effort levels at different points of the season, because then you can say that for any team, including when you get to the playoffs. Like, if you think you're the best team and you're going to go in with the mindset that you're the best team and then you get smoked by the other team because your mindset was too cocky, then, you know, I think the conditioning side is pretty important. I would find flaw with that kind of approach.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think that in this situation in particular from a Toronto side, I mean, good for Morgan Riley, the Vancouver boy, you know, scoring against the team and ideally maybe getting himself back on track a little bit. It's unfortunate that now we have a bit of a break because the last couple of games he'd looked pretty good. But I mean, where is the star power that Toronto league-wide, everybody knows they've got? They know they've got. We as fans know they've got. Yet again, literally nada. From Mitchell Marner, William Nylander, or Billy from Calgary, as they're calling them lately. Austin Matthews, John Tavares. Like, where are these guys? Again, I know Vancouver's a tough team, and they were frustrating. They were frustrating.
They were hard on the forecheck, which I, as a fan of the Canucks, was very happy with.
There's no room, which is the point. I know that's the point, and I get that.
Yeah.
But you got to find a way, adjust on the fly.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And that's, you know, I don't want to say that's entirely coaching, but I think a lot of times too, that's the players having to recognize that and knowing what to do in that situation, right? Because you're going to play teams that are hard on the forecheck all the time, especially teams who are, you know, higher in the standings. But no, I agree. And that's what kind of makes me almost believe that whole idea of sitting back the first half of the year and then turning it on, because that's how they were playing last year, the entire year. They were hard on the forecheck all year, and they showed that, you know, not just the Toronto game, but like specifically the Toronto game, they showed that they can play that way again. So it's exciting for me as a Canuck fan, but it's also kind of confusing because you're like, where the hell has that been all year?
Would you say a guy, because I know Quinn Hughes has had his share of injuries and is going through some right now, would you say, my point being that watching Austin Matthews and this year specifically, some of the injuries that he's had, you've seen like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde from Austin Matthews this year, or is it Mr. Jekyll and Dr. Hyde?
No, you had it right the first time.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Jekyll, I read the book twice. I don't even know. With, you know, looking like Austin Matthews, being injured, taking a while to kind of recondition, whether it be shoulder, back, wrist, whatever the hell the speculation is going to be on Austin Matthews. And then I would say the last 2 weeks, he's been like Austin Matthews traditional Austin Matthews.
Yeah.
You know, shooting, scoring, dominating, stealing pucks away, protecting the puck. My point being is that as a Canucks fan, a guy like, say, Quinn Hughes, who dominates the game when he's at the top of his game, Do you notice or feel that when he does have an off stretch or an off game, do you just feel like he's playing like crap, or are you more worried about, like, say, okay, he's just coming back from an injury, you know, maybe that's why he's a little slower, or that's why, you know, he's not shooting the puck as well? Or do you just think that you get kind of frustrated and just feel like they're just not trying or not playing well?
I'll be completely honest. I've never been in a situation where I've been frustrated at Quinn Hughes' play. I mean, ever since he's been on the team, he's been impressive every single game. There might be a game or two where you're like, oh, I wish he would have done this instead or whatever. But like, for the most part, he's rarely, you know, he's rarely a frustrating player to, because you know what he brings to the table, and he typically brings it even when he's injured, you know? So it's, but he's also not flashy. Like, he's not flashy like what Austin Matthews is, right? Like, he doesn't play the same game. He's really good defensively. He's really good. He's an amazing passer, obviously a really good skater. But like I said, he's not flashy. He's not going to go out there and score 70 goals, right? So, you know, I think it's a different kind of feeling when you look at somebody like Quinn Hughes. Now, Elias Pettersson, okay, right?
That Elias might be Pettersson more of a comparison.
Is a more of a comparison because the guy's making $11.6 million and he was a 40-goal scorer, or almost a 40-goal scorer, but he's not going to be anything like that this year. So he's probably, in terms of like a comparable for Canuck fans, he's the guy that most Canuck fans right now are kind of like, where is Petey? Like, where is he? Especially when you've got a player like Hedl playing alongside you. Like, you know, Hedl's really impressive, but it doesn't seem to change what Petey's doing this year. It doesn't seem to elevate his game like it should. And that's the thing that's the most frustrating.
You know, listen to this guy over here, Paul. Like, Quinn Hughes impresses me every game. It must be nice. Yeah. My God.
I just, you know, what I mean by that ultimately is just like, he doesn't ever make you kind of rip your hair out because he's not making those obvious mistakes, and he's not doing the things that most flashy players don't do, right? Like when a flashy player doesn't shoot when he should shoot, then you're ripping your hair out, right? Whereas Quinn Hughes, he knows the right thing to do. He's either passing or shooting, but for the most part, he's shooting.
Paul and I's hairline is the complete opposite, I would say.
You've seen my hairline, so, and then Paul and I have the same hairline.
Paul gets used to it so nobody notices. I try to cover mine up. Rogaine! Using of the Rogaine.
That's right.
Well, we're talking about, like, effort levels, right? And, you know, I know that you and I kind of look at William Nylander sometimes, and you know, I'm happy at least that his play, I believe, has improved over the last 2 years, especially just before the extension and getting the extension. I think his play has improved a lot. He's become a lot more elite, but he still has a bit of that laziness that you see. You know, he's leading the league in breakaways. Now, I'll give that to that. He has good offensive awareness, but at the same time, is he cheating a little too much?
Absolutely.
And that's why he's getting, you know, as many breakaways as he is, right? It's a little...
That, you know, concerning. Sorry to cut you off, but that breakaway that he had in the game against Vancouver, and he obviously took a look too quickly or something. He lost the puck. That must have frustrated the crap out of you.
Yeah.
Or is that something you kind of like, okay, here we go. Like,
I mean, it's frustrating because if you're going to cheat, he's the guy to do it because he often puts the puck in the back of the net.
Yeah.
He's got a great shot off the rush like that. Like, he hardly ever dekes. It's usually a shot low blocker, five hole. And that right-handed shot kind of shooting across the goalie, I think it's deceptive.
Yeah.
Mitch Marner's kind of similar, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But not quite as a rip of a shot as what Nylander has.
Right.
So, yeah, of course it's frustrating. But it's also frustrating the fact that why wasn't he back-checking with the rest of the team? Because that's really what you need against a team like Vancouver.
Yeah.
You know? So you cheating trying to get offense, I guess, is fine in the Sheldon Keefe days. Well, this is Berube. This is not the same team. This is not the same style of play. You've got everyone collapsing except Swedish Meatball over there. And then, you know, and then he goes up ice. And yeah, of course, the chances are great. But I'm not going to lie to you. I've sat there numerous times and watched him accept a breakaway. And I roll my eyes thinking, what the heck are you doing up there, man? And then, you know, he scores, and I don't know, yay. But it's like, really, he's not, in my opinion, he's not playing the game the right way.
Right.
And And at the end of the day, playing the game the right way is what's going to win you championships.
Yeah, you know, I will say this as a Canuck fan. I feel like to that specific breakaway, I think Kevin Lankin is not getting enough credit because he did poke check as well. He poked the puck away. But I think what happened ultimately, it was a combination of Nylander, you know, taking a look too fast and then Lankin and poking at the same time. So, you know, like kind of combination of him screwing it up and Lankin and getting in there too. So, but I mean, ultimately, like as a Canuck fan, I'm happy with the outcome of the game. I'm really happy with the way Vancouver played ultimately in terms of defensively, like forechecking hard. You know, one of my favorite players last year was Nils Höglander because of the way he was hard on the puck. And this specific game, I felt like it was like old school Höglander, you know, the way he was hard on the puck and stuff. So, yeah, I was really ultimately really happy with the game. I could see where your frustrations would come from as a Leaf fan, especially against Vancouver being where they're at in the standings. But if there's any actual validity to that statement of them sitting back until now, then maybe that's something to see, but I guess we'll see what happens the rest of the way.
I'd say my biggest takeaway from that game, watching the two periods that I was able to, and I was going to watch the third when I got home, and I'm like, yeah, I'm just not going to bother. Even though the score, like, it wasn't lopsided. No. I think it was close.
Yeah, it was a 2-1 game.
My biggest takeaway from that game was it looked like Vancouver, I don't want to say prepared, because obviously they were prepared, but it's like, I would describe it as they could just get back to playing hockey.
Yeah.
And we all know what I mean by that as far as what's been surrounding the team or what's been between the ears of the team, the proverbial ears, so to speak,
yeah,
for the last 2 or 3 months. And it may not be over, right? But that is probably my biggest takeaway from the game is just the fact that Vancouver looked relaxed, prepared, ready to go.
Yeah, totally. Like focused.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, we're talking about a couple of Swedes, right? We're talking about Pettersson and Nylander. So one other Swede that's been kind of bugging me lately, and he's on the Maple Leafs. OEL keeps taking I was going to swear for a second, but I'll just use a normal word, bad penalties. Taking really, really bad penalties, and it led to the Brock Besser power play goal. And, you know, it was a tight game as it was, and it still was even a tight game after Vancouver scored.
That was a really dumb penalty.
Yeah, but it was a really, really bad and stupid penalty, and he's been doing that the last couple of games, and it's a little frustrating because, you know, other teams' power plays are clicking, and the Leafs are very hot and cold with theirs. So it's, yeah, you know, when you're seeing a power play against you, you're like, oh, well, crap, I guess they're going to score. And then you see the Leafs get a power play, it's like, I don't want you guys going to power play. You seem to be better on 5-on-5.
So, yeah, I totally, you know what, the thing you're seeing with OEL is the same thing I saw with OEL when he was a Canuck. It's very similar, kind of streaky, and then, you know, those kind of dumb, it was an ozone penalty, right? Like it was in the Canuck zone?
No, I believe it was in the Leafs.
Oh, it was the Leafs. Okay, yeah. So I stand corrected about that. But I mean, in the end, I mean, it was a careless penalty. You know, you're what are you even lifting your stick up for? Like, yeah, you know, it doesn't make any sense. As a high-staking call, puts them on the power play. Luckily, it was only a two-minute. Not that it matters for anything because they did get scored on, but, you know, could have been a four-minute.
Other than winning the Stanley Cup, maybe he learned a little too much in Florida.
Yeah. No, I don't, you know, it, and unfortunately it is something that we you know, Canuck fans, I'm sure, you know, the Florida fans feel the same way, because I'm sure he made a lot of mistakes over there too. I mean, I watched the playoffs last year and I remember seeing him make mistakes, but you know, it does help when your team wins the cup for you. But yeah, ultimately it is a frustrating thing to see a player like that take stupid penalties.
You know what else was kind of crazy and surprising to see, you know, obviously we're looking at OEL, how about the Super Bowl?
Oh man, yeah. So what did we predict last episode for the Super Bowl?
I believe we're all predicting the Chiefs to win it.
I didn't.
No, I actually predicted the Eagles to win. However, the one part that I know for sure I was wrong about was I said it was going to be a close game. My God, that was scary.
Yeah, I think I said 31-27.
I said something like, I said low scoring. I said something like
10-7.
Yeah, like 10-7. Yeah, I was like, it's going to be like a field goal. We'll win the game.
Yeah.
My goodness, I couldn't believe the way that the Eagles just took it to them. And it felt like for literally 3 1/3 quarters, it felt like the Chiefs had no answer. And then they finally scored in the fourth quarter. It was just ridiculous.
Yeah, like I think they were up, what, 34-0 at one point when it came to...
Yeah, 34-0.
Yeah. And it, like in the third quarter, like the Chiefs like had no answer. It's almost like there was too much pressure to have that three-peat, and that it just kind of...
I think also there a little bit was underestimating the Eagles too. Like Eagles were very impressive.
So the Eagles were up 24-0 going into halftime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think was said in each dressing room? Like, what do you think the vibe was? I mean, now, do you think Philadelphia was just riding high? Like, we got these guys. Or do you think that, okay, we're focused. We're up. Let's take it to them in the third. And was Kansas City like, oh, it's 24 points. We got Mahomes. We're good. Or were they like, oh, my God, guys, we got to go. Like, what do you guys think the vibe was?
I'll be honest. I think, you know, it was literally the same message on both sides. Like you said, I think the Chiefs went into the dressing room and went, you guys, we've got two Super Bowl championships in a row. Let's go out there and get the third. That's probably what the message was. And the Eagles were in their dressing room saying, we have a chance to take it home, boys. Let's do it. And that's exactly what they did.
Yeah. Yeah. They came out. They didn't take their foot off the pedal at all.
Nope. It was, you know, I know you're not much of a football fan, but like from a football fan's perspective, it was about as close as a drumming you're going to see on a team
in the championship
game. That like I don't think I've ever seen anything that bad where it was just like they were being embarrassed. And you could see, you know, on the bench when Mahomes would come off the field and you'd look at all the, you know, the offensive players and they're just like, what do we have to do? You know, what do we have to do to finally get some points on the board? And, you know, I personally, like, as much as I said, you know, that the Eagles were going to win, I did hope that Kansas City would turn it around and at least make it a close game. Because, like, it just, there's something to be said about championship games that are like that, where a team just gets destroyed, no matter what the sport. I just can't stand watching teams get, you know, get just run over.
So what did we say last podcast? Or I know it was my point about this, and I had said that I think Philadelphia's defense is going to overcome Kansas City's offense.
Right.
Now, I looked at a stat that I thought was not true, to be completely honest with you. And it was Philadelphia, in the first half of that game, allowed 23 gaining yards.
Yeah.
Against. 23. Yeah,
you have to consider the fact, too, and this is the other stat that's really unbelievable, the amount of turnovers that Kansas City had to give up.
Yeah.
Like, Mahomes threw, I think in the first half, it was like 4 turnovers, which was like ridiculous. And it was a combination of like interceptions and like also fumbles and things like that.
Well, Vic Fangio sacked Mahomes 6 times.
Yeah,
in that game.
Yeah. So that just goes to, I think, really what more than anything, it just goes to show you how strong the Eagles were this year. There's no doubt in my mind they were the best team in the league. Obviously, that they won the Super Bowl, but the fact that they showed Kansas City who they were, you know. And to me, that's a pure example of, you know, if they come back with the same team next year, you know, I think there's no doubt in my mind that they're going to come back and win it all again.
I think one of the things that kind of stood out for the Eagles, too, is the fact, you know, the Chiefs are obviously very well known for their offense. You know, Kelce and Mahomes, obviously, all the time. It's very balanced lineup for the Eagles. I noticed when you're watching them play, like, it's there's not one person that's a superstar over the rest. Like, everyone seems to pull their weight with the team. And you know, they did rely obviously a lot on Saquon Barkley, but Jalen Hurts had a game too. Like, he definitely played better than Mahomes.
He led rushing yards at 72 as the quarterback. He had a touchdown on the ground, threw for 97 yards or something. No, that can't be right. Oh, no, that was Saquon Barkley.
Yeah.
Had 97 yards.
Yeah, yeah.
But just insane.
I'll tell you the most kind of surprising stat on the Chiefs side of things was how little Travis Kelce played a part in that game.
Yeah.
So much so that people are asking the question, is he going to retire? You know? He has a podcast with his brother. I'm not sure if you guys are aware of it. It's called New Heights. It's actually a really great podcast. So, if you guys are interested in hearing some hilarious discussion by two former NFL pro, well, one former NFL pro and his brother, Travis, who still plays. It's incredible. It's a really funny podcast, really great. And the most recent podcast, they actually talked about the Super Bowl game and you know, how upset it was. And of course, I don't know if you were familiar with this, but his brother Jason played for the Eagles.
Yep.
And of course, Travis playing for the Chiefs. Travis beat his brother Jason on his last game as a pro, Jason's last game, and they won the Super Bowl. So kind of an incredible situation, but they're obviously best buds, right? So, and it's cool. It's a great little podcast. And it's so funny when you think about the fact that he played almost no role in that game. This is a guy who's like the new Gronk, right?
Yeah,
when you consider the role he's supposed to play.
That's true.
One could say that during a cruel summer, there'll be some blank space where Kelsey will ideally shake it off.
Maybe. He'll either shake it off or he'll...
write a love story?
Yeah. I was going to say something about 22, but I couldn't think of anything. no, but I'm sure, you know, he did say in this podcast that he's going to take some time. He's not going to worry about it right now. He's going to take some time and obviously get over the whole thing. And, you know, he did say outright, like, the Eagles were better than us. Like, they deserved that win. So
Kelsey goes, maybe Taylor's ready to have babies, and that's why he goes. Who knows?
Well, I mean, there is speculation they're engaged, but I don't know if it's actually legit yet. But it's cool. It's, you know, what it is, what it is. But, you know, I do wish the best for him no matter what, because he is a good player. You know, he's a difference maker in the NFL. And, you know, if he decides not to retire, you know, he still could play a huge part in the Chiefs and whatever they have going in the future. So
very true.
Yeah. Well, what's the next thing we're going to talk about here, gentlemen? Oh, hey, post NBA trade deadline. When is that? Is that already passed?
February 6th.
February 6th.
Thursday.
The NBA trade deadline, and we saw some pretty crazy trades, didn't we?
We did.
What's probably the most kind of surprising trade, do you think, that you...
We most definitely have to be the Luka Doncic.
Yeah. Right? Luka Doncic going to the Lakers. He's going to play with freaking LeBron James. I mean, general manager LeBron James.
Yeah. Referee LeBron James.
Team owner.
Yeah.
Arguably the best shooting guard in the game, right?
Yeah. Has been for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, and, you know, Davis is no, you know, what's the word I'm looking for?
Slouch?
There you go. Thank you.
I'm slouching as you say that.
He's uniform, though, you know, he's got a unibrow, right? So, but, yeah, he's no slouch. You know, obviously he's strong defensively against the boards and stuff like that. But, you know, I'd say Doncic, for sure, top three player in the world. You know, could even be over LeBron at this point. I'd still say LeBron probably holds a lot of weight. Is still the best player in the world, even at his age. But it's not far in between on that. Davis, you could say he's maybe further down, top 20 kind of thing. But
do you have it in front of you, the details of that trade?
All right. So if we're looking at the breakdown of the trade, it was a three-team trade. The Lakers received Luka. They received Maxi Kleber, Markieff Morris, Dallas Scott, Anthony Davis back in return, Max Christie, and a 2029 first round pick. And then I guess it was for cap reasons and so on.
Yeah.
The Jazz got Jalen Hood-Schifino, a 2025 second, or two 2025 seconds, one from the Clippers and the one from the Lakers.
Right.
So they kind of got, you know, the lower end of it just because for the money reasons. But, you know, again, if you're looking at the best player in the trade, they always say that the team that has the best player in the trade wins the trade. You'd probably have to say the Lakers won the trade.
I mean, yeah, definitely. Definitely.
There's been a lot of backlash to the Dallas GM in regards to making the trade. A lot of people are absolutely hating it. You know, I think he justified his reasoning a little bit because he felt that Dallas's defense wasn't that strong and they really wanted somebody that would help solidify their defense more, be able to play with Kyrie. So I understand, I guess, his mindset, but it's anytime you trade a star like that, and the stars already make an impact. Doncic is already playing and making an impact on the Lakers. it's you're always going to deal with a lot of backlash in response to that kind of stuff.
I can see why the fans would say that. Obviously, it's never easy losing a star player, right? And I mean, I should know being a Canuck fan, but it's never easy losing a star player. And if your team doesn't get better because of it, then it becomes more and more of a challenge. Has Dallas done anything else to kind of solidify their offense after that trade?
I don't know that they made any other moves. I don't remember that the...
There was nothing in the headlines that I can remember of any major trades.
I got all the trades sitting here. I'll fire through them, and then if there's one of the ones that you want to specifically talk about, we can do that.
Mm-hmm.
So the Bucks acquired Kyle Kuzma as part of a three-team trade. Chris Middleton went back to the Wizards, and Middleton was pretty decent player for the Bucks. So, but mm-hmm. I guess they saw more out of Kuzma. Former Toronto Raptor DeLon Wright went to the Knicks as part of that deal. Again, it was a three team trade. So, Kuzma seems to be one of those players. He's a bit polarizing in regards. He's got so much skill, but he never seems to stand out like the other star players does.
Right.
There was Jaden Springer went to the Rockets from the Celtics. I don't know a whole lot about him. Seems a little bit more like a under the table kind of trade. Daniel Theis went from the Pelicans to the Thunder. I believe he was drafted pretty high in his draft.
Mm-hmm.
Again, one of those players that hasn't entirely worked out. Jonas Valanciunas, former Raptor, went to the Kings. He was originally on the Wizards. Big trade for the Warriors and the Heat, and
that's a multiple teams, man.
Multiple teams that were involved. So you had
that. Is basketball the only sport where this happens?
I mean,
hockey, definitely. Maybe three teams you get involved, but it's like, whoa, three teams. Yeah. The NBA, it's like, oh, just about half the league, no worries.
We'll include six or seven of them. You know?
Yeah. I mean, it's true. Like you don't even see that really in the NFL.
This is a big one.
Yeah. Like, I'll go through every single piece of it here. So the Warriors got Jimmy Butler, 2 second round picks from the Heat, or 2 second round picks from the Heat, cash. The Heat got Kyle Anderson, Andrew Wiggins, former first overall pick for
Canadian
boy.
Yep, for the Cavs and Canadian boy, Davion Mitchell, a protected first round pick from the Warriors. The Jazz got KJ Martin, Josh Richardson, 2028 second round, 2031 second round, and some cash. The Pistons got Dennis Schroeder, again, former Raptor as well. Lindy Waters and a 2031 second round pick. And
2031.
So we're looking at 6 years.
That's so crazy. I know the NBA is the other league that seems to be the only one that does that too, where you're drafting like picks from like 6 years from now.
Well, and you see like for some of the star players, like they'll have like four first round picks included to acquire them kind of thing. Like,
that's true.
Any one of those picks could turn into a star player. It's kind of crazy.
It feels like a comedy show.
It does at times. The Raptors got former Raptor for the third time now, PJ Tucker.
Yeah, that's right. From the Jazz, yeah.
Welcome back.
Second round pick and some cash. So yeah, in total there is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 players. Jeez. In that deal.
Yeah, nine player trade.
Bunch of draft picks and cash.
Yeah, that's crazy. Absolutely. I'm not even going to begin to ask you to break that down. Yeah. Like, that's just ridiculous.
I'm not going to. Like, all I know with the Butler, he had been suspended a bunch of times because he was doing things that I guess were detrimental to the team and really wanted out. I guess there was a lot of speculation that he was going to go to the Suns. But
well, he was refusing to participate in team practice.
Yeah.
Sanctioned events, meetings he was missing. Yeah, it's... I don't know. And that attitude, man, that demeanor in a professional atmosphere, get out of here.
And honestly, I feel like the NBA is the only league that has that too. You don't see that anywhere else where it's like a player wants, like, I don't know how to word this. Like, I know in the NHL in the past, we've had NHL players who were like, I don't want to play for this team. So they end up getting traded. But where they won't participate in like team events and stuff, like they are not being good teammates. Like, to me, that's just so unprofessional.
This isn't the first time with Jimmy Butler. He's had problems at other teams. He had problems on the Sixers. He had problems on the Bulls. Like, it's not the first time he had problems on the Wolves.
So, obviously, it's an ego thing more than anything.
Like, again, I'm all for a bit of cockiness and confidence in yourself. But when you believe you're more important than the rest of the team, like, you can go screw off.
To be fair, and maybe that's a whole separate podcast we should discuss this. But, like, I am so against cockiness. I'm very much for confidence, but cockiness is what seems to be the issue, right? Because there's a difference between cockiness and confidence. Cockiness is somebody with arrogance, right? Somebody who thinks they are the best, not just they're good, but they're the best. And to me, it's one thing to know you're the best, and it's another to be a good teammate. And that's, to me, that's the difference.
Think about it this way: in the NHL, it was January-ish, somewhere middle of January, I think. Braden Point missed a team meeting.
Right.
He didn't play the next game.
That's right.
Braden Point is a premier player in the NHL, and John Cooper was like, "Nope, sorry, take a seat, pal." Yet he's right back in there the next game, ready to go. He knows he messed up.
Yeah,
right?
I'm sure he apologized to his teammates and said, "You know, yeah, I'll be better, guys."
You know, who knows? Maybe he slept in, right? His alarm, his phone didn't charge, whatever the case may be. It doesn't matter. You miss the meeting, you're done. NBA players go out of their way to miss a meeting.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
You talking about practice?
Not the game.
More deals. There's one deal that went through at the deadline, but it actually has since been rescinded. Mark Williams went from the Hornets to the Lakers. I guess one of the conditions that was part of that deal fell through. Another Butler went to the 76ers. So Jared Butler was acquired from the 76ers for Reggie Jackson and a first-round pick.
Reggie Jackson? Wasn't he like 68 or something?
Not that Reggie.
a different Reggie Jackson.
The Suns acquired Yusuf Nurkic for Cody Martin and Vasilije Micic. I'm loving how I to pronounce those names. The Cavs traded for DeAndre Hunter, gave up Canadian Caris LeVert, Georges Niang, 3 second-round picks, and then pick swaps in the future. The Hawks acquired for Bogdanović. I wouldn't have mind seeing him on the Raptors, but the Hawks had gone out and acquired him for Terrence Mann, Bones Highland, and a 2025, 26, and 27 second-round pick. I think looking at the rest of the deals, there's a couple of them are not really a lot of big notable
names. Yeah.
The ones that I liked that the Raptors made, they did a huge one. And they're saying that it's the steal of the draft, too, actually. Or of the deadline, sorry. Was acquiring Brandon Ingram from the Pelicans.
Ah, okay.
So Brandon Ingram is known to be, you know, not the top superstar, but he is considered a superstar in the league. And they bought low on him because he's got a high ankle sprain, so he's likely out for the remainder of the year, or might even make it in the last few games, but he's probably out for the whole year. Some of those high ankle sprains take a long time.
It's kind of a next season type.
You're better off breaking it,
to be honest with you. Yeah, quite literally. I've had a high ankle sprain, so I know.
Yeah.
It takes a while. I think for me to fully heal from mine, it took almost 8 months.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things, but all they had to give up to get Brandon Ingram was Bruce Brown, who was not happy already with the Raptors as it was known. He has a large salary, so they were able to make the salaries match. Kelly Olynyk, I was a little sad to see him go. He's a Canadian born.
Yeah, Kelowna or Kamloops? One of the two.
I believe it's Kamloops. Canadian born center who wasn't playing amazing for the Raptors, but you know, he played his role.
Mm-hmm.
Just a first round pick and a second round pick. A lot of these star players, again, somebody like Brandon Ingram, any other team, if he was on the top of his game, might have given up 3 first-round picks, maybe 4, to get him kind of thing. So they bought super low on him, and then a few days after were able to sign into an extension, a 3-year extension, at lower than what superstar money, max money is. Like, he's making $40 million a year.
$87 million Canadian.
Yeah. Over the next 3 years, starting next year, but a lot of superstars make, you know, in the higher 40s to 50s. So, you know, they actually got below market value slightly.
Not bad. I always love it when the team I cheer for, you know, gets a deal on a good player, right? But I mean, obviously, it's one of those wait and see type situations because of his injury.
That's crazy that they signed him to a $40 million a year extension for 3 years without him even playing a game for them.
They know how important he'll be, I think. And obviously they're in a rebuild, right? The Raptors are, so.
Yeah, but my concern is that the rumor around the league and the reputation he gets, he's a bit of a ball hog.
Mm.
Well, the Raptors are a very young team. Is that exactly who you want to be your mentor?
Kind of reminds me of JT Miller a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. At this point, I'd probably actually be comfortable with the fact, because even when you looked at Kawhi when he played, like he was a good player in terms of passing, but he wanted the ball in his hands, and he made a difference on the team. They won a championship with him, right?
True.
And the Raptors tend to be a very pass heavy team as it is. Scotty Barnes is awesome, but he tends to pass a lot. So if you got a guy that's willing to throw the dime up and can make the bucket, please go get him. I'd love to have him on my team.
I guess it's, like I said, it's a wait and see situation. You never know what he's going to bring to the table until he actually gets to play. And you know, it could be a coaching situation. Maybe he's just, you know, the coaches he's had in the past, they haven't been very good at communicating what they actually want from him.
Yeah.
And then he just appears to be a ball hog when really he's just playing a specific structure that they like to play.
Yeah, it's true. You know, they traded, like I said, Davion Mitchell. He went to the Heat. I was expecting more from him when they acquired him in the beginning of the season. But one of the players they got from the draft, Jamal Sheed, overtook Davion's spot. So it's, you know, it's fine to see him go. And then they also acquired James Wiseman, who was the second overall pick in his draft. From the Pacers, I guess there was like a handshake agreement that if they acquire him, it alleviates money for Indiana for, I guess, re-signing next year. And all the Raptors got was a 2026, or all the Pacers got were a 2026 second round pick. And then not even 2 days later, the Raptors waived Wiseman. So
yeah, we know you're lying when you talk about the Jays. You don't do anything. Yeah. I mean, pretty successful, I'd say, for a rebuilding team in the Raptors, and very successful for a dominating team like the Lakers.
Yeah.
Overall, for the trade deadline, anyway, it sounds like there was,
You know, from the outside looking in as a fan, like you just ultimately want to see like big moves happen, right? And it's exciting to see changes in teams, even if it's not the team you cheer for. You're just kind of like, this is crazy. And the cost that it takes to make those trades happen is definitely kind of intriguing. And in the NBA, like we said, you know, we're seeing first round picks from like 2020 or 2031 go out, and you're just like, what is happening?
When you involve five teams in a trade, for example, like that one we saw, how many phone calls does that take? How many text messages? How many emails? Like, are we talking this takes a month to do?
Yeah.
Or longer?
Probably.
Had to have taken time for that. Probably. It could have been something you'd done in a day. It had to have been talked for weeks.
Like, how many employees, how many staff members in on this? Your analytics department, your accounting department, your GM, your owner. It's insane. Five teams.
Yeah, it's definitely intriguing. It makes me glad that I don't do that job, because I'm sure it's a lot of stress. There's a lot of stress.
In hockey terms, I'm not sure I've ever even seen a four-team trade.
I would love to be. I've never either. I would love to be a fly on the wall in like a war room watching a trade go down in the NHL. I think it would be so intriguing to watch. Just to see like what the idea of trading, say, like a player like JT Miller, like what that looked like.
Yeah, the conversation, the whole work with that, yeah.
Because I know you weren't just dealing with one team. There's multiple teams who are asking like what it's going to take to make the trade happen. And then when the actual like serious trade talks happen, like it would be really cool to kind of see that play out.
You have to wonder, it's, you know, it's Hollywood eyes, but if you look at like a movie like Moneyball, where Billy Beane goes to talk to Mark Shapiro in the movie, and they're talking about players, about, you know, possibly exchanging and trading players, whether there's any kind of banter talk like that in regards to how, you know, what players can we have, what players do you want, kind of thing. And then when they're getting serious, you know, kind of how they play their cards, and whether it's similar possibly to that, like that movie.
I thought you were going to say Draft Day.
I was thinking Draft Day in my head while you were talking. Yeah. It's like, that's kind of a neat spin on the war room, and how, like, if you haven't seen Draft Day, you should really check it out.
Yeah.
Kevin Costner does it's a fantastic movie.
He's incredible.
I've seen it probably 40 times, and I was scrolling whatever service I was scrolling last night, and I saw it on there, and I went, oh, I could really watch this again. I really could. And I just think it's so cool how, you guys have seen the movie, so you'll know, but how what happens at the beginning of the movie, and then what ends up happening at the end of the movie, and just the full circle it's kind of like a fun, giddy movie, especially if you're a sports fan.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, and to your point with Moneyball, Paul, how in that situation, or when they are that scene where they are at the trade deadline and he's in his office with Jonah Hill, and you wonder sometimes if it happens in real life the way it did there, with like how quickly a trade can happen.
Yeah.
Like, hey, can you get Dombrowski on the phone? Yeah, sure. Hey, I'll give you Pena. Sounds good. What do I get? Cash in this. Sounds good. Okay, write it up. Bang, done.
Yeah.
Like, does that happen?
Yeah. I'm sure some trades happen that way. I'm sure there is some like that, especially last minute on the deadline day, because, you know, they're like, we've been talking in the past, there are certain players who we're pretty certain will get traded, like in the NHL, for example, but they're not going to be traded until deadline day, because it's like one of those things where people aren't going to, they're not going to kind of show their cards until it's last minute, right? Because they're trying to get one player and then they can't get that player, so they decide to go for this player instead.
Yeah, maximize value, I guess, on the player too. Albeit, I'd say when you're looking at the trade deadlines nowadays, because there's such an emphasis on youth and so on, that the better value is the earlier trades than the deadline, because you're basically in a rush to get what you want at that point and might be willing to give up too much compared to if you have more time to plan. Like you would have with earlier trades than the deadline.
And I mean, I'm sure smart managers out there probably sit there and go, this is what I'm willing to lose in a trade on deadline day, right? Where if somebody comes to you and says, you know, I want this player, let's say he's your, you know, top three centerman, and I'm willing to give you this, but you're willing to go as low as this kind of thing, right? You probably have that stuff in your mind, before it comes down to it, you know, or before anybody even approaches you with that move.
I wonder if they've got like an 80-inch TV up on the wall and some sort of program that somebody's come up with, or some app that they use where they've got like groupings of possible trade scenarios and the teams they're with, and how they can kind of click on this and visit that and these players and move players in and out here while they're on the phone. And like, there's got to be just some sort of NHL app for GMs.
And I think that's why ultimately I would love to be a fly on the wall, just to sort of see what happens, because it is intriguing. Yeah. It's really intriguing when you think about it. I mean, let me ask you guys a question. Is there ever a time where a trade has gone down and you've just fallen in love with that trade? Maybe not necessarily your team, but like just a trade in general. And it doesn't have to be hockey either, but like a trade has gone down and you've just fallen in love with it because of how it went down.
I mean, most recently, I would say when I heard about the Rantanen trade, I was so intrigued to find out any information about it, for that matter, because it just seems so shocking, right?
Yeah.
So I would say I feel that way a lot of times about shocking trades, but then you also can get on the other side and be frustrated with trades too, i.e. last year when Vegas traded for Timo Meier. And it was like, come on, this guy's injured. You guys are doing it again?
Yeah.
What are you, like, how is this even allowed to happen? And then so you get that frustrated side too.
Totally,
right?
Yeah.
In all honesty, it's probably right now, it's been the two major Raptor trades, to be honest. Like Kawhi, I knew that he was, when they were acquiring him, he was a top five player in the league. To give up DeRozan, who was like a heart and soul player for the Raptors, and Jakob Poeltl, who was an up-and-coming, you know, pretty good defensive center. I thought it was a lot, but I was in love with the fact that, they were acquiring probably, like I said, top five player in the world, and it worked out. Like it was probably the best Raptors season that I've seen, and I had watched them in winning with Lowry and DeRozan before, and I was happy with them. But again, when the playoffs came around, you're like, oh crap, here we go again, kind of thing. You know, especially when they ran into LeBron every time, it was impossible. When you have somebody that can like actually go head to head with LeBron, they didn't have to play LeBron that year because he was with the Lakers, and the Lakers were not doing good. It was one of those exciting trades. I was excited about that, and I'm actually quite excited to see what's going to happen with Brandon Ingram. I really like that move because I believe it's going to add a little more balance to the team.
Cool. Yeah, I you know, when I think about like specific moves that I've fallen in love with, I think ultimately I agree with Brandon when it comes to the Rantanen trade. I think that's probably the most intriguing, and it's because it was out of left field. I don't think anybody expected Rantanen to get traded at all. But you know, it was really impressive to sort of see Colorado make that play. Not only that, but Colorado actually got better with the trade because of Neches going toward them, right? So and he's been playing really well. So it's kind of interesting to kind of see what happens there. But I don't know if you guys caught on with my clever kind of wordplay, but I use the word fall in love because we're talking about our movie topics today, which of course is romance because we've got Valentine's Day coming. By the time this podcast airs, it'll actually have already passed, but no reason to still, we can't still talk about our favorite romance movies.
Before we do that, just quick question. Do you guys have any special plans with anybody? I mean, I know, Paul, you're recently out of a relationship, but
yeah.
Is there anything
he's single,
you got,
ladies?
You're going to take Noah out for a nice dinner? Or, you know, Joe, what are you doing? Are you doing anything with
it's
the wife?
It's funny you ask because literally, I think it was this morning when I woke up, my wife Faye and I were sitting there and we're just kind of like, man, Valentine's Day is in a couple of days. And we both looked at each other, we're like, we're not doing anything because we both have to work Clippers. We both are doing
right,
the Clippers.
Right.
So for those of you who don't know, I'm the rink announcer for the Nanaimo Clippers as well as the DJ. And Faye, my wife, she works in the box office. So we both are working Clippers games. That's our Valentine's. But, you know, we...
find the janitor's closet.
We've been together... Yeah, really. We've been together 12 years and, you know, we've spent a lot of time doing things together and spending a lot of time together. And we will always have more time to do that stuff. So for us, Valentine's is sort of just another day. We don't typically look at it like we need to do anything special. We don't get each other gifts or anything like that. We just, you know, we try to make time for each other and spend time together when we do have a chance. So that's our thing.
My original plan was to be in Calgary for Valentine's Day with who I had been with. Like I said, recently single again, so changed a bit. I'm going to be hanging out with a friend Friday night.
Cool.
You know, that'll be
the gist
of it.
Yeah. I think what we're going to do tomorrow is we're just going to go out for a dinner. I actually think we're going to go to the Black Bear.
Nice.
Maybe sing a couple of songs. And then we're actually going to do kind of our Valentine's Day weekend next weekend. It just worked out better timing-wise and whatnot. But, I mean, we're kind of the same. We don't go all out. We do more on our anniversary, you know, things like that, our wedding anniversary. But Valentine's Day, we acknowledge it. You know, buy some chocolate, stuff bear, that kind of thing. But
we were just in Vancouver for Shane Gillis at Rogers Arena, which was a lot of fun. So that was kind of our romantic getaway because we did get to spend some time together.
Yeah.
We spent the day together basically just hanging out in Vancouver. And we both absolutely love Shane Gillis and stand-up comedy. So it was a really awesome experience. And we it's funny. So we're kind of cheapskates. Like we didn't want to spend a whole lot of money. So we didn't get a hotel or anything. We literally just slept in the car at the ferry terminal.
Right.
It was cold, but it was a lot of fun and we enjoyed it. So
it's an adventure, right?
Yeah, totally.
Sometimes the memories you get from something like that is way more important than dollar value in anything. Yeah.
That night was the day that JT Miller was traded. So yeah. It was kind of interesting. I was in Vancouver when that happened. So let's talk a little bit about our favorite romance movies.
Yeah, I when I think of obviously a good romance film, or you know, like I said, you're hanging out with your girl, or you know, just you have a group of couples together, and you're enjoying, obviously, you know, want to watch a romantic movie. A lot of people can, you know, divert to Titanic as probably being one of those ones where it kind of catches your attention because I guess, you know, with Rose being as young as she is, Jack being as young as he is in the movie, that kind of adds that bit of giddiness. And so the girls really like it. You know, maybe the guys are cringing a little bit sometimes when they're watching it. But
I think sometimes, too, sorry to interrupt, Paul. I think sometimes, too, that too many guys out there are too, like, they're hiding their kind of emotions, you know, they're hiding their emotions. So a lot of guys are afraid to say that they like chick flicks or they like romance movies.
Yeah.
I'm not saying us specifically, but I know that there are guys out there who are just like, oh, chick flicks, screw that. I'm a movie guy. Like, I love movies in general. And I like movies based on whatever, like, the premise of the movie is supposed to be. I find it laughable sometimes when a guy's like, oh, it's a chick movie. Like, oh, there's other reasons why people like that movie, but whatever.
I have no problem with a touching story. Whatever. I mean,
your favorite movie of all time is a touching story.
It is. It really is. Yeah. So, I mean, I would say for the romance side, I'm more of like a rom-com.
Yeah.
I would say favorably kind of guy. Cool. I'm not necessarily just straight romance, but a lot of there's so many movies out there that really have kind of multiple genres together anyway. is there really that many just romance movies that aren't like Hallmark movies or something like that now? Anyway.
Like cheesy. Yeah.
A lot of them are combined. You know, you mentioned Titanic. Another one that I thought of earlier would be Pearl Harbor.
Mm.
Action, historical, but a serious love story as well, right? Yeah. You know, it kind of combines everything.
Well, and you know, the thing about it is when I think of the actual technical aspect of making a movie like Pearl Harbor and like Titanic, both being historical, you know, movies, it's taking that story, say the Titanic, for example, of the ship that sunk, and adding a love story to it to sort of add that entertainment aspect for the movie. It you know, you have to create something to keep the audience interested because we all know what happened in real life. So you add that love story, and it's the most important aspect of making a movie like that, especially a love story, is making sure that it's an intriguing story in the end.
Yeah, very important. You talked about rom-coms. Usually, whenever I am dating somebody, my go-to kind of romance movie at always first is 50 First Dates with Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore. Loved them together in Wedding Singer. That's still such a fun movie to watch. Yeah. But 50 First Dates, I don't know what it is. I find it hilarious. I find their love story very unique, too. It's definitely one of my favorites.
In turn, I was going to say one of my favorite rom-coms is The Wedding Singer.
Yeah. Nice.
So that was kind of my pick for, like, the one that stuck out for me the most when I thought rom-com right away. There's so many, but that one I was just like, oh,
you could argue every Adam Sandler movie is a rom-com.
Kind of, yeah.
In the end. I mean, even Happy Gilmore is a rom-com.
Yeah, fair enough.
But, you know, when I think about, so just moving away from the comedy aspect, when I think about actual romance movies, probably number one altogether, and maybe you could argue it, but for me, The Notebook would be number one. And it's funny because I have a bit of a story attached to this. So I used to work as a movie projectionist, right? So I worked in a movie theater. I was a projectionist. We used to have like staff movie nights where we would get to watch a movie after the theater's closed. And one night we had two movies. One was The Notebook. And then people who didn't want to watch The Notebook got to watch like some action movie. I don't remember what the action movie was. I watched it, but I don't remember what it was. I decided not to watch The Notebook because I didn't want to watch a chick flick. That was my mindset at the time, right? I was very young. I was like 22 or something like that. But I remember our movie got out, the action movie got out, and we're standing in the like hallway, and then The Notebook got out right after, like while we were standing there. And all these people are coming out of The Notebook and they're all just shedding tears, just crying their eyes out. Our manager, who was a guy, came out and he's crying. And I'm like, what is going on? Like, what happened to this movie?
Tear gas.
So I'm like, well, I don't know, maybe I'll give it a shot and I'll watch it, right? So I sat down, I'm trying to remember, I'm pretty sure I had a girlfriend at the time. I can't remember if I was single or not. It was a long time ago. But I decided, you know what, I'll give it a shot and I'll watch the movie. And I remember watching it, and yes, sure enough, at the end of the movie, it was the most sad thing. Have you guys ever seen The Notebook?
I love The Notebook.
Yeah, so
it's my top pick for a romance movie as well.
When you talk about 50 First Dates, I compare it a lot to The Notebook, just based on the premise of kind of forgetfulness, right? For those of you who don't know with The Notebook, it's all about dementia, right? So it plays a huge part in the movie. There's this big story that builds up to what we see as dementia in the end. There's actually a movie that I recently saw. It's not a romantic movie, but it is called Here. It's with Tom Hanks and the girl who plays Jenny in Forrest Gump.
Robin Wright.
Yes, Robin Wright.
Robin Wright.
So Penn. Tom Hanks.
Not Robin Wright again.
No, Penn. Okay. Yeah, I think she's Wright.
No longer.
She's Wright. She's not Penn anymore. anyways, it's a movie that literally the camera is stationary. And it takes place in a house over the timeline of the planet Earth, not just the house, but like the planet before, like the dinosaurs times and stuff like that. It was really intriguing. But in the end, there's a major twist at the end that you're just blown away by, and it has a lot to do with dementia. And so, you know, that storyline, and for me, it's relatable because my grandma has dementia. So that storyline kind of hits close to home. And so watching The Notebook was kind of my first experience with it, and it blew me away the way it hit me emotionally.
Yeah, it seems to hit a lot of emotions for people. And, you know, a couple, you know, when you look at the two main actors, Rachel McAdams and Ryan Gosling, that was kind of a breakout film for them.
Both of them, yeah.
I remember Ryan Gosling in the show Breaker High. I don't know if you guys ever saw
I remember that.
He was also in Young Hercules.
He was also on the Mickey Mouse Club.
Yes, he was.
With Justin Timberlake and J.C. Chazet, and him and Justin Timberlake were best friends apparently growing up.
I like that Rachel McAdams and Ryan Gosling are both Canadian too.
Yeah. From the same town, dude.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, they're from the same town.
Yeah, a lot of people knew her from like Mean Girls prior to that, and then obviously a big break for her was that one, and Wedding Crashers was pretty big for her too in that regards. Yeah, and they played their characters so beautifully too in the film. Yeah, a lot of iconic scenes in that.
I would say her young character pissed me off.
Yeah.
She was a little, I just wanted to be like, oh, you don't do that.
But when you think about it, in terms of the era that that movie takes place in, that's exactly how people were, especially women at that age. They were, you know, they were set to do whatever they needed to do. And no matter how they felt about the person, you know, if she's with somebody else, whether she loves this guy or not, she's going to stay with him because that's what the plan is, right? So it's kind of interesting when you think about it. But yeah, that definitely The Notebook for me is maybe number one, if not up there with, say, you know, I think about the classics, Casablanca.
Yep.
You know?
White Christmas.
Yeah. And you know what's interesting about those older movies, and I mean, even The Notebook can be thrown in there, but like just their most quotable movies.
Oh, totally.
You know? Here's looking at you, kid. Like... So incredible. Have you ever seen the movie The Holiday? It's a Christmas movie, but that movie, as cheesy as it is, and I mean all Christmas movies are cheesy, but it is for sure a romance movie. And everybody who's in it, I just love. Jack Black's in it, you know.
Is that Kate Winslet in that one?
Yeah, Kate Winslet. Okay. Kate Winslet and Jude Law.
Cameron Diaz.
Yeah, just it's a clever movie. But yeah, Casablanca, I mean, geez. Have you seen Casablanca? You've seen it?
No. I have not.
I know I saw it when I was younger.
I watched it in film school. We had to watch it. I was forced to watch it, but I loved it. It was a really wonderful movie. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
What am I? It's in my list of top films ever.
100%.
That one I have not seen.
Yeah.
Oh, man. If you want to know artistically what it's like to have your memories erased, like even if you're considering the idea of dementia where you can't remember things, artistically the way that they process Jim Carrey's character losing his memories because they're erasing them for him, mm-hmm. It's such a unique take on it, and even some of the visuals are really, really kind of interesting in that film to see.
It's symbolic. The movie is symbolic,
very symbolic.
You know,
and the idea of fate too, because it's, I won't give anything away about the film, but there's a fate aspect to it that some things are just meant to be, right? And that was one of the things I really loved about that film.
Totally. Would you agree that probably the best kind of romance movies are the most quotable ones?
Sure. I mean, you could probably say that about any movie, really.
I guess the best movie in general would be the most quotable one, right?
Yeah.
Jerry Maguire. Okay. Probably one of the most quotable movies out there.
Oh, definitely.
a really great romance movie. I would call it a rom-com, but ultimately, yeah, it's a really great romance movie. And the number one line, I mean, I can say I've used it on my wife. You complete me? Come on. Come on.
Now, does Faye ever say you had me at hello?
No, she usually laughs it off and walks away. But.
And then she goes, Joe, show me the money.
Show me the money.
Glenn Frey was in that movie, you know?
Yeah.
From the Eagles?
No, I never knew that. Actually.
He played, I can't remember the character's name, but he, I can't think of his name. That's going to bug me. But basically, like a guy, an agent, and he wouldn't take any shit off Tom Cruise. And I remember them reaching out to Glenn Frey in the Eagles documentary. They profiled it, and they said they reached out to Glenn Frey because they said to him, you know, hey, we got this movie coming up with Tom Cruise, and we think you're the guy that's not going to be able to take any crap from him. What do you think? And there's a scene, and basically, oh, I'll show you, Jerry. Here we go. And just hangs up on him. Oh, his name was Dennis in the movie. That's what it was. Yeah.
That's hilarious. Yeah.
Just kind of a little cameo.
I've got one more. It's sort of my, if it's ever on TV, I have to watch it, even if it's like near the end or whatever, I'll still watch it. Sleepless in Seattle.
Oh, yeah.
I love Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks is one of my favorite actors, but that movie in particular, it's just, it's such a heartwarming movie. And I just, it's one of those movies I just have to watch every time it's on.
I got to ask you guys a question. It just popped into my head because it's kind of a romantic movie. It's kind of a courtroom drama, which I love. And it has Tom Hanks in it. And Denzel Washington, for that matter. Have you guys seen the movie Philadelphia?
Yes.
Yes.
Like that, I always forget about that flick.
But I don't consider it a romance movie, but.
No. I mean, I know it's not, but I mean, what made me think about it was that there's a bit of romance in
it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, with his relationship with Antonio Banderas. But I always forget how much I like that movie, and you just had reminded me. It just kind of popped into my head. But I don't even know where I was going.
I just remember.
I just wanted to point out there was a good movie.
I just remember that movie being, obviously for its time, was very controversial when it first came out. But it definitely is an acclaimed film. And, where would the world be if we didn't have that movie, you know?
Tom Hanks won Best Actor in that,
yes,
didn't he?
Yes. Yeah. It probably put him on the map as a serious actor, too.
Oh, definitely.
You know?
Have you guys ever seen Meet Joe Black?
That's with Brad Pitt,
Brad
right?
Pitt, Brad Pitt. Yeah.
I have never seen it.
Anthony
I know
Hopkins
of
Hopkins too.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Now that movie came out, I believe it was 95 or 96. I can't remember what year it was, but when it came out, I would have been young teenager, 13, 14 at the time. I saw the previews for it. I thought this is a stupid film at 13, 14. I didn't really care for it. So I was more interested in action films and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad I didn't see it at that time. I saw it when I was around 19 years old. So it might have even been 20. Talk about, in my personal opinion, is probably one of the more complete films when you're looking at story, when you're looking at character development, when you're looking at how each person is playing their role. Like Anthony Hopkins has so much presence in that movie, and he's this billionaire who wants to keep his legacy. You have Brad Pitt in the film who is portraying death.
Yeah.
Like death has embodied him. Claire Fulani wasn't super well known at that time. She's not a very well known actress now, but again, stood out as his daughter, and their dynamic, between Brad Pitt and Claire Filani's characters, in terms of how they're connecting, and that he's a different person than who he actually is, who she actually met in the beginning of the film. I thoroughly enjoy watching that film every time. It's got such a climactic ending too, which makes it so interesting to watch.
I feel like Brad Pitt, he doesn't get enough credit for being in all these amazing movies.
Yeah.
He's a really talented actor, obviously, but to be in a movie like that and then to go forward and do a movie like Benjamin Button, like that kind of movie, like it's just incredible.
Yeah, he kind of goes all over the map, too.
Yeah.
Anthony Hopkins, doesn't he play a billionaire in every movie he's in? Yeah. Seems like he's always
the
rich and powerful.
The Edge, yeah.
The Edge, Fracture. Like, that's another excellent movie, not a romantic one, of course.
I'm going to point out two romantic comedies, rom-coms specifically, just because I saw them and I'm reminded of them. Notting Hill. I really love that movie. It's a cute movie. It's like whatever, but The Princess Bride. Probably the number one rom-com for me just cuz it's so funny. It's
so funny. Wish.
Anybody want a peanut? Oh, just so funny. Just so funny.
I actually have a slight hate on for Hugh Grant.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I know you're not alone. Like
he's boring as hell. I find.
I really liked this movie, Notting Hill. There's a couple of movies he's in that I like, but I totally see what you mean. I totally see what you mean.
Might change your mind if you see a movie like this movie called About a Boy, and it's got a really young Nicholas Holt in it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you know who Nicholas Holt is.
Mm-hmm.
And again, gets him noticed obviously as well. That's a really good role for Hugh Grant and his acting abilities.
Fair enough. Yeah. Okay.
Well, boys, how do we feel about that one? Kind of a shorter show today, but we got a lot of stuff to talk about, and we got to talk about our favorite romantic movies. Ladies, if you are looking for a partner, our friend Paul over here is single and ready to mingle. And he's blushing big time. But
ChristianMingle.com.
That's right. But you know, hopefully we've given the audience some ideas for movies they can watch with their loved ones. And you know, if you had no idea what to watch, there's lots of options out there. But the ones we mentioned, I think, are probably some of the best for sure. Now, make sure you guys reach out to us on our social media. We're available everywhere at The Puckin' Pod. And you can also find us, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. Once again, for The Puckin' Pod, my name is Joe.
My name is Brandon.
And I'm Paul.
We'll see you on the next one.